God, before time began, before creation had come to being, God determined to bring us to share in His glory. God determined, planned, that we should be with Him in eternity, in all His splendour. 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 7. We speak of God's secret wisdom, a wisdom that is hidden and that God destined for our glory before time began. This He was to do through His Son Jesus. Jesus was the Lord of glory, the eternal Son of God, the heir of a great kingdom, a kingdom of people who were like Him. You see Him described there at the end of verse 8 of the passage tonight as being the Lord, the Master, the ruler of glory itself, of the kingdom of eternity, of heaven. Jesus is the Lord of glory. He is the one for whom and through whom God has made the world. Everything was created through Him, but everything was also created for Him. And you and I were part of that which has been created. And so you and I have been created for Him. But it was God's plan in creating us for Him to create us to share in His glory, to share in His kingdom and His power and His might and His splendour. Yet, when this Son of God became a first century Jewish man whom we call Jesus, when this Lord of glory became human, He came in order to be crucified. He was born to die. Jesus came into His world in order to pay the supreme price for the world. He came into the world in order to bear the rebellion of mankind, to pay the penalty of rebellious people, the penalty for their rebellion, to die in order to set us free, that we might share the glory of God. In order for us to come to that place that God had destined we should from before the foundation of the world, it was necessary for His Son to become human, to take upon Himself our sinfulness, and to die. And therefore, Jesus crucified rose again from the dead to be head of a new humanity whom He calls to join Him, as He calls you this very night, to join Him in His glory, in His splendour, to be part of that new world, to live with Him for eternity. Is Christianity stupid? What makes you of Christianity? What do you think about it? Is it a stupidity? Talking of a God and of His Son and of a man born and dying a couple of thousand years ago in relative obscurity? Is it a stupidity to be thinking about a glorious future and a kingdom and a heaven? Is it a madness to go on with a book as old as the one that lies open in front of us? Many people say yes. To talk of God and of His Son and this first century form of Roman execution, of eternal destinies and of rising up from the dead, it's stupid. It's nuts. Jesus died for my sins. Well, bully for Him. I'm still living for mine. From the world's point of view, it seems pretty stupid. But now, there are those who are being saved by this cross. There are those who know what forgiveness is by this message about the cross. There are those who know God and his wisdom and his power by this cross. And they don't say it is stupid, but rather this is the very key to the universe. This is the meaning of existence. This is what it is all about. This is life itself. This is the very purpose for which we exist. This is the most profound and magnificent information that could ever be shared from one human to another, that could ever be thought. In your wildest dreams, this is the ultimate reality. No idea can get such radically different valuation than the cross of Jesus. It's madness, or it is the very essence of wisdom. As Paul puts it in another letter that he wrote, for some people when they hear it, it's a message which is the smell of death. For others, it's the message which is the smell of life. One a sweet fragrance and the other a stench. Preaching the message that I am tonight is a very smelly business. How can we know? How can we know whether this is the truth or not? How can we come to know God? Paul is saying that he actually has the mind of God. You'll notice there in the end of the chapter, last phrase he's got there, the mind of Christ. He's talking about knowing the thoughts of God in verse 11. How can you know that these are the thoughts of God or not? How could you come to that evaluation? How could you come to know God's thoughts? What is the source of our knowledge? Well, it's a big question, the source of knowledge and the way of knowledge. In philosophical terms, it's called epistemology. It's a great area for philosophers to play with. How do you know? And even how do you know what you know? And how do you know how do you know? And it just goes on and on. There's no end to the epistemological question. It's great fun. And those of you who have done philosophy and enjoy the game will, I'm sure, bear with the simplicities of the approach that I give it tonight. It'll be a nod and a wink to you as to the direction in which a heavier argument would give, but I'm not actually here to give heavy arguments of an epistemological nature. Whether I could or not's another question. I'm not here to do that. In fact, as verse 2 and 3 and 4 talks about, Paul says, I resolve to know nothing amongst you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. But how do you know what you know? The modern forms of arguments, of course, are very silly. And they're easy to lampoon because of their crass stupidity. They are seen most frequently on the lips of politicians and in TV commercials, radio commercials, newspaper commercials and so on. But they are the forms of argument that people believe and act upon. And while the philosophers can have great fun and the logicians can have great fun, in fact, we can have great fun at their expense, we have to take into account the fact that that's how people think. If it wasn't how people thought, then they wouldn't work, and they clearly do work. They make a lot of money for advertisers as well as the manufacturers in getting politicians elected. You know, they use tests, they use phrases like university tests, prove, and then you fill in the blank. Beautiful people use, and then fill in the blank. Most intelligent people say, or most intelligent people read, or most intelligent people believe, or no intelligent person would hold, etc. You see, you just have some statement like that, people like you like, and then you fill in the Kellogg's cornflakes. And you then have an impression, you have an idea, you have a sense, you have a feel that if I'm going to be one of those kinds of people, then I must. And that is about the level of the logic of it. And Christians can do it, and Christians can be accused of it too. As we parade out great ones and say, this great sportsman, he's a Christian, therefore. Therefore what? Nothing really flows from it, does it? But yet the other alternative is there. You see, you can't be a Christian and be a good sportsman, can you? I mean, the argument is used either way, and it's illogical either way. And yet it's the way people think that... It's the way people think. Leaving aside that kind of argument and method which most people use, there are two popular forms of knowledge in the modern Western way of approach which people hope to find, by which people hope to find God. Broadly, we can describe them in terms of rationalism and empiricism. Rationalism is a, as I'm defining it tonight, and my sermon, I'll make up the words my way, rationalism broadly is a deductive system. It is the understanding of logic, of reasoning, and the using of reasoning as a foundation and authority for matters of knowledge. It is an excellent process in fields like mathematics or chess. But it is not always a useful field in terms of discovering truth. It is very good. In fact, maths is what it is. But it is very limited. It has frequently been, of course, attacked by the empiricists. Empiricism is an inductive system. It's the system of experimentation and observation, of using our sense data to come not to to come to knowledge. It's based on experience alone. The rationalists tend to come to their conclusions on theories. The empiricists tend to come to their knowledge on experience. It, of course, is excellent in descriptive studies of tangible phenomena like the hard sciences. But, of course, empiricism only really works provided you've got rationalism running along with it as well. And so the use of mathematics and the use of logic and the use of reasoning go hand in hand. It's not as if ultimately they are two completely different schools. Rationalism alone has very limited ambits in which it works. Just logic systems, reasoning systems, mental games. But empiricism can look at all kinds of areas of life, from small microbes up to massive systems of the stars and planets, but requires the rationalism to work. Now, both of these are good and valuable ways of knowing, which we use frequently, in fact, every day, and have a real validity about them, provided you don't try and push them beyond their bounds. But neither of them can really grasp all of truth, or all truth, all areas of truth. And many who are, for example, in the humanities have difficulties with them. You can't keep on running experimentations in the area of history. The science of history, empirical historical studies, is fairly questionable. You have to stretch the meaning of empiricism and scientific experimentation a long way to get in English poetry. Well, you can do it, but you wind up with the analysis of how many times which poet uses the word and, or the, or cat, or, and it gets very strained and strange because, well, it's like when I remember went to university, I did psychology, which may explain why I have such difficulties in life now. Maybe though I had such difficulties why I did psychology. However, you'll be glad to know I got out of it after a year or so. But the first few weeks were spent convincing us that psychology was a science, because unless it's a science, it's of no value to anybody, and therefore it has to be a science, and therefore there was massive argument. It never crossed my mind that it was a science or it wasn't a science until I had these lectures, and then I knew it clearly wasn't. Because the lady protested so very strongly. Right? You really had to demonstrate that it fit into the empirical mould of knowing, because that's the only really acceptable way of knowing. It was running into a problem of not facing other ways of knowing, in particular, that of revelation. You see, logic and experience are part of the method of knowing called revelation, but they are not the same as it, and they can't work without it. Revelation is something different. Revelation requires the object of your information to show you something. Revelation is the way of knowing when you are looking at something that wants to be found. something that has a will. Revelation, I mean, the word means to show you, to show, to demonstrate, to display. And when you are looking at something that can conceal or show, then you require it to show you in order to find, in order to discover. You discover because it reveals. It's a showing of itself. And when you are dealing with a person, not a thing, something that has a will, so therefore is a person, you need revelation. Empiricism and rationalism alone or together will not work when the studying is of a person. Because only a person will want to show themselves, and only if they want to show themselves will you discover. In fact, it's a prerequisite for knowing any person that they reveal themselves. Who was my childhood hero? Did have one. Yeah, that's a laugh, yeah. Who was my childhood hero? Now we'll have a few moments of rationalism, shall we? I want you to just sit there and think. Reason it out. Right? No empirical investigation. No scientific experimentation. Just think. You work out who was my childhood hero. We'll just have a few seconds break to give you that chance to think, and then you can tell me. Ray? My brother Peter. The response of everybody else shows you the stupidity of that answer. The Lone Ranger. No. Superman. No. Don Bradman. W.G. Grace. I mean, it's speculative guess is the method at the moment, isn't it? It's not really reasoning to a conclusion. You can't arrive at a rational conclusion that his hero was X. All right then, let's try it by experimentation. Let's try it by an inductive method of reasoning. Let's see if we can devise or set up some form of experiment, some sort of inquiry, some kind of investigation that will be able to establish who my childhood hero was. Now, frankly, I'm not going to let you do this one because there is only one form of experimentation that's available to you, and it's a phony form, but there's only one form, and that's called torture. And I'm not in for that. We can just push this kind of form of communication so far. But I mean, what other form of experimentation could you think up by which you could devise who my childhood hero was? I mean, what could you do? You could scour through the kinds of people in the press and the media at the time in which I was a childhood. But that wouldn't tell you then, would it? You could go around and ask friends and say to them, well, who did Philip always talk about when he was a child? You could check out with my parents and things like that, couldn't you? But you can't be sure that they will know. And anyway, they will give you different answers because they heard me at different stages. And I may never have told them, you see. In the end, there's only one way you can find out. That is if somewhere along the line, either to them or to you now, I reveal it. I show you, I tell you, I declare to you, and of course that's why you want to torture me. Because by torturing me, you can get me to confess who my childhood hero was. But of course torture is only a form of forced revelation. You haven't really come to an empirical study at that stage, you've just forced revelation, that's all. And of course it may not work. In other words, the will, my will in this occasion, is the crucial factor in you finding out this piece of information. There is no way you can know it unless I tell you, unless I declare it. And that is true not just of me, but of your childhood hero too, isn't it? And it's not just childhood heroes, that's true of us as persons. It's only as we actually start talking with each other and I start telling you things about myself that you can come to know me. It's only as you start talking to me and you start telling me things about yourself that I can get to know you. And if you care to keep yourself hidden, if you care to always answer in a monosyllable and always the neutral answer, nice day, you think so? Been out today? Off and on. You know, if you wanted to, you can keep me completely away from you, can't you? We can have a 25-minute conversation like that, and at the end of it, I can say, well, I haven't got the faintest clue who that bloke is. I don't know what he likes, I don't know what he thinks, I don't know what he feels, I really don't know him. But it might only take 2 or 3 seconds to meet you, and you can say, I'm so-and-so, I've come from here from this, I've done this, I do that, that's my job, this is where I come from, that's how many brothers and sisters I've got, I like so-and-so and so-and-so. And immediately I can start saying, well, I know him. How do you know somebody? It's because they reveal themselves. Now, persons are very different to almost everything else. You see, when you are looking down your microscope, you always are hopeful that the thing that you're looking at is not looking back up at you. The things that look back up at you are persons. And therefore, the whole method of investigation must be different than when they are inanimate objects. That is, if God is a thought, then rationalism is the way to discover him. Think thoughts, and you might struggle to the right abstract concept that will capture God. There is the classic and famous thing called the ontological proof for the existence of God. I believe that God is the greatest and ultimate, you see, and then you think I can conceive of something of which there is nothing greater. Now that thing must exist, because if he didn't exist, then I could think of something even greater, namely the same thing that does exist. So therefore, God must exist. Now you see, there is a rationalist approach to God, but it has reduced God to an idea. That's all it is, an idea you found hard to follow. Well, that may be because I explained it badly, but it may be because you found it hard to follow. It's an idea. That's the kind of God, that's how you came to it. But you didn't even know who my hero was, yet you've worked out God. If you think that God is an object, well, then you go and investigate, you study the object, you feel its texture, you smell it, you see it, you hear it, you relate to it like you do all kinds of objects. And if that is the case, empiricism is the way to know God. But if God is a person, then you will only know God when God chooses to reveal himself to you. That is the only way you can know a person. It's by revelation. You'll still need rationalism in the sense that you'll still have to hear what he has to say and think through what he says. You'll still need some form of empiricism because you'll actually have to check out. Did he say it then? Who heard it? Under what circumstances? I mean, there's a certain element in those other ways of thought are in. But basically, the prerequisite is him wanting to be found. Now, this is what Paul is writing about. Look with me down to 1 Corinthians chapter 1, 2, verses 11 and 12. Verses 11 and 12. Watch, mate. Now watch. For your sake, I better tell you that I left my watch at home and Derek's going to give me one. Verse 11 and 12. For who among men knows the thoughts of a man except the man's spirit within him? In the same way, no one knows the thoughts of God except the Spirit of God. We have not received the spirit of the world, but the spirit who is from God, that we might understand what God has freely given us. You see the points I've just been making in the last few minutes? No one knows me except me. I'm the only one who knows who my childhood hero was. I'm the only one who knows what. And anyone to whom I care to give that information of myself. Likewise, no one knows God except the Spirit of God, and anyone to whom the Spirit of God has been given. And we have not received the spirit of the world, but the spirit who is from God. Why have we received the spirit, says Paul? So that we might understand what God has freely given us. Thus God's wisdom is from God. It declares, it reveals, it shows God. And that is what the apostle says he now has and is declaring to us. It used to be concealed, he says, back in verse 7. It was concealed. We speak God's secret wisdom, a wisdom that has been hidden. None of the rulers in verse 8 of this age understood it. The rulers of this age could be supernatural forces or could be rulers like Herod and Pontius Pilate and so on. It's hard to know which he means. None of the rulers of this age understood it, because if they had, they wouldn't have crucified the Lord of glory. The wisdom of God was hidden and concealed, like my childhood hero is from you. And it was hidden and concealed for a very good purpose, not like my childhood hero. It was concealed by God so that God's purposes would not be thwarted, so that the rulers of this age wouldn't know it, wouldn't understand, and so would fulfill his plan and purpose of crucifying his son, the Lord of glory. It was concealed. However, God has now revealed his plan to mankind. He has now sent his message, transmitted by his Spirit, the Spirit who really does know, because he is the Spirit of God. And so Paul says, we have received the Spirit so that, verse 12, we might understand the gift that God has given us. And verse 13, this is what we speak, not in words taught us by human wisdom, but in words taught us by the Spirit, expressing spiritual truths in spiritual words, or possibly should be translated to spiritual men. It's ambiguous in the Greek whether it's words or men at the end of the sentence. The Spirit of God is now giving the very words of God, has declared, has sent this message, so that we now, verse 16 at the end of it, have the mind of Christ. We now know the thoughts of God. But as it is the Spirit who's sent, so he is spiritually received. Those who do not have the Spirit of God will not appreciate the message of God. Those who do not have the Spirit of God will not accept the message of God. Verse 14, the man without the Spirit does not accept the things that come from the Spirit of God. They are foolishness to him. He cannot understand them, because they're spiritually discerned. It's not just a matter of intelligence or lack of intelligence. It's got to do with the fact that God's Spirit is the means of communication. And only those who have received the Spirit of God will understand what the Spirit is saying. Those who do not have the Spirit of God, well, their wisdom stands in the way of them understanding God. Their preconceptions stand in the way. Their rebelliousness against God stands in the way. Their will prevents them from receiving the message. They reject the message as being foolish. Very often I read books that give me the impression that Freud discovered that people's thinking was influenced by their personal behaviour and choices. Often enough, you read books that give you the impression that Marx thinks. And Marx discovered for mankind that people's thinking was affected by their socio-political and economic status in life and situation in life. Both those ideas, of course, are as old as the Bible. They may be older and elsewhere as well. I'm not claiming the Bible's the first place that you find that way of thinking. But you do find it in the Bible, and you don't have to find it in Freud or in Marx, because it's been there a long time ago. What we do with our mind is not purely rational. What we do with our mind is not neutral in terms of our lifestyle and our patterns of existence. What we do with our mind is we play games. Clever, sophisticated games like chess, and stupid and silly games like Trivial Pursuit. But we play games. That's what we do with our minds. And with our minds, we are able to explain and excuse and rationalize the behaviour choices we want to make on completely different bases. On the basis of how fast our mother weaned us, or on the basis of how it will further our political desires, or how it will gratify our particular senses. But we make up reasons, we make up arguments, and we argue them out, and we logically discuss them, and we will show evidences and pull them into account, which will explain why we want what we want, and be able to make us feel that we have good reasons for what we have. Fundamental to the heart of man is the rejection of God. All of us reject God because we all want to play God ourselves. We all want to run our own lives our own way. That's part and parcel of it. And we keep on finding good reasons to argue the case as to why it is right for me to do my own thing. And now comes the voice from God saying, I am God and you must change. Now what do I do with that? Well, the person who is full of his own rebelliousness against God says, rubbish, that wasn't God's voice. The room didn't shake. The lights didn't go on and off and on and off. Yeah, that wasn't God's voice. Jesus, just a man. Oh, very good man. Yes, taught wonderful things. Haven't read many of them lately, but I'm told they're great. And wouldn't think twice about it. You see, the unspiritual man does not receive the message of God because his whole life is programmed against God. He does not want God. The mind of the flesh cannot submit to God's will, says Paul to the Romans. But the person who receives the Spirit of God, their life is changed and transformed. And as they hear the words of God, they say, that truly is God speaking. That is what I want. And that message will change and transform them. And what is this message that is so transforming? Well, the message that Paul speaks amongst the mature that he mentions in verse 6 is the message he's always spoken. That is, that Jesus, the Lord of glory, has died for us so that we may share his glory. It is Jesus and him crucified that Paul preached, and he wished to know nothing else but that, Jesus and him crucified. That is, you and I were created for glory. But we have rebelled against God and his plan for us, and therefore are doomed to destruction. But God has taken upon himself our destruction in order to bring us to glory. And how has God taken upon himself our destruction? By becoming man and being crucified in our place. This then is thinking God's thoughts. You may say, well, I just heard you say them, but they didn't sound very profound thoughts to me. Well, that tells us something about you, doesn't it? That is God's thoughts. That is the key to life. That is what it is all about. That is what the universe is about. That is what you are about. That is why you were made, and that is where you are going to. How then do you come to know God's thoughts? By listening. That's how. And seeing it's a spiritual activity, I'd suggest to you listening prayerfully. For God speaks a word. It's not clever, it's not eloquent, it's not highly sophisticated, it's just the message that Jesus has died in your place. But as you hear that, as you understand that, you need to be pleading for God in his mercy to open your eyes that you will understand this gift that he is giving, that you will receive his Spirit to grasp the great truth that Jesus has died for me, that I might live for him. But the key is not to look in on your own self all the time, introspectively. For the answer isn't within you. The answer is in God speaking. The key is to look not so much at the process of how I know to God as the message. That is, Jesus crucified. Because this thought has no longer been concealed. This thought is no longer secret. The thoughts have now been made public for all to hear. Jesus died for you. Forgiveness for whatever you have done, Forgiveness is available. You don't have to pretend it wasn't wrong. You don't have to pretend that you're all right. Forgiveness is available. God has revealed himself so that you can now know God and you can know your future of a complete certainty. Who you are, where you are going. Do you know God?